This is the elk hoof rot, elk hoof disease diagnostic update. This is a briefing, and we have Dr. Kristen Mansfield here and Sandra Dunker. Welcome. I know you've been hard at work on this subject. You guys have given really terrific, detailed, informative, and I have to say, really interesting presentations in the past, so welcome back.
Thank you. Is this on? Yes, okay. All right. Well, good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the Commission. My name is Kristen Mansfield. I am the wildlife veterinarian with the Wildlife Program. I am stationed in Spokane, but these days I'm spending a lot of time in Southwest Washington dealing with this problem we have in elk there. So I briefed the Commission a year ago, June, on where we were at on our diagnostic approach at that point. A lot has happened since that time, and I'm here to present the latest findings and conclusions from our diagnostic investigation. So there are a lot of wild ungulate hoof diseases out there. Usually they're sporadic, and they can be caused by a whole lot of different things. Here are some photos that were taken during the fall hunting season of 2012, all from eastern Washington. We have an elk, a moose, and a mule deer. They all have hoof issues going on, and they're all different kinds of hoof diseases, and none of these are the same as what we are seeing in elk in Southwest Washington at this point. So there is always kind of just a background level of hoof disease in wildlife in Washington. Beginning in about 2008, we started receiving a really markedly increased number of reports of a hoof disease of some sort in elk in Southwest Washington. They seem to be coming mostly from the Boisford Valley area. And these reports, the numbers of them were far above and beyond kind of that background level that we know that we always have in wildlife. So we suspected something was up. And furthermore, in addition to this being reported a lot more frequently, it did seem to be spreading. So we began asking ourselves the questions, is this a new hoof disease in elk? Is it spillover from domestic animals? We do know that there are lots of infectious hoof diseases of livestock. Foot rot of domestic sheep is very common, as is digital dermatitis of cattle. And most livestock hoof diseases are made a lot worse by wet conditions, as we have in Southwest Washington. So this kind of helped us form our questions and design the initial steps of our diagnostic investigation. So we began our investigation with the help of a lot of people in the field. We used a lot of labs. The list on the left includes veterinary institutions and different agencies that all had veterinary staff out helping us in the field, collecting these animals, doing the necropsies, doing the sample collection. The list on the right are all the different labs that received parts and pieces of elk from our collections. This is just an overview of the collections that we did. There were four sessions, and the reason that there were four different times, it'll be illustrated a little bit later on in the talk, but essentially our first collections were done in March 2009, which was the March following that big uptick in reports that we received beginning in 2008. We had to kind of work around hunting seasons and do some logistical planning before we could do our first collections in March of 2009. When we did that, we focused on the most obviously affected animals, which were adult cows in this case. We collected five affected animals and three control animals from an area that at that time was not affected by this disease. What happened is when we collected these older cows, we found very severely diseased hooves. The hooves had been diseased for a long time, and there were a lot of chronic, nonspecific, secondary changes that were just the result of the hooves being diseased. So we weren't able to really tell what the primary initiating cause was. So that is why we reason that, well, we need to collect younger calves. We're trying to get an early lesion and trying to get the disease early so we can see what is there first, what's causing this disease. So we collected 9 to 10-month-old calves next. Turned out those had feet just as bad as the adult cows. The following August, we thought, well, you know, we need to get even younger. So we tried 3-month-old calves. That was probably a little bit too young. Had some suspicious lesions, but we were not able to say anything definitive with those. And then finally, this past January, we targeted 8-month-old animals, and we were very pleased to find what we think was early disease, and we learned a whole lot from these January collections. So when we examined the animals, we did a complete necropsy, which is the term you use when you're dealing with an autopsy, but with animals you call it a necropsy. We looked at every tissue that you can look at in an animal. We looked at it both with our naked eye, and we sent it in for a pathologist to examine microscopically. So we looked at everything from the adrenal glands, the lymph nodes. We looked at a lot of these tissues here. For example, the thymus and the spleen and the bone marrow, these are tissues that are involved in the immune system of animals, and we looked at those. We have no evidence of immune suppression, no evidence of toxicity, really nothing abnormal above the hooves. In addition, we did some radiology, which is x-rays, looking to see if there's any joint involvement or primary joint disease or primary skeletal disease. We had no evidence of that. Histology, that's just the term you use for microscopic examination of tissues. Parasitology, we looked for viruses, we measured trace minerals, and we did routine bacteriology, and then later on did some specialized bacteriology. So just a quick summary. The radiology, again, no significant primary lesions on this. The histology, no abnormal tissues at all above the hooves, even when the animals had very severely affected hooves. The parasitology, all of our control and affected groups had similar parasite loads. No significant virus isolations. We only got one virus, and it was out of an east side control out of Yakima County. Trace minerals, which is looking at your selenium and copper and zinc levels. We did find low selenium and copper in these animals, but that was not unexpected because we know that the whole western Pacific coast essentially is deficient in copper and selenium. And then serology is where you measure antibodies to disease agents. And so all of those were negative to non-significant as well. So our conclusions, copper and selenium deficient, not a surprise. In general, that, you know, a severely copper or selenium deficient livestock species, it can lead to kind of, you know, poor immunity, maybe generalized, not as healthy or thrifty as you would like. We don't know that that's the case in elk. I mean, these elk have evolved in this area for eons, so I'm not sure that we can apply those same conclusions to elk that we could to domestic animals. And we did conclude that this is a primary hoof disease. There is no other significant tissue involvement. So we did report our findings of the initial collections that we did in March of 2009. These were presented at the Wildlife Disease Association meeting that following summer. And we published them in a peer-reviewed journal article that just came out a couple of months ago. So I'm just going to kind of now take you through those different collections we did and kind of what we found and how it led to our next steps and then what we finally were able to conclude as a result of that. So this is our winter 2013 effort. It was February and March, and this was follow-up to those adult cows that were too severely diseased to really tell us what started the disease. So these are our 9 and 10-month-old calves. And as I indicated earlier, when we looked at these calves, they were every bit as diseased as these older cows. So we were not able to tell a whole lot from these, except this time we did some specialized bacteriology and special stains, as we discussed. And what we did find were these black squiggly things. These are spiral-shaped bacteria called spirochetes. And the very diseased animals had these in their hoof tissue. But since the feet were so diseased, we weren't we didn't know if they were secondarily there, just part of that, you know, secondary changes in the diseased hooves, or whether they were playing a primary role. So it still wasn't really clear to us. Although we did also seem to have a pretty good association between disease status and finding these spiral bacteria in culture, confirmed by PCR and then on histology when we're looking at them in the tissues with a special stain. So they did seem to be a pretty good correlation there, but we weren't real sure, you know, what does that mean? Are they there because of, or are they the result of? We did some sequencing of these, and we did find that the spirochete-shaped bacteria were in the genus Treponema, and furthermore, they were a species that is similar, if not identical, to Treponema bacteria that cause a hoof disease in dairy cattle called digital dermatitis. But still, we figured we needed to find those earlier lesions to really feel comfortable in what we were seeing. And again, when you see something like this that's all packed with mud and secondary infections and scar tissue and all these chronic changes, it's hard to know that. It's hard to know what's significant. So in summary, though, from those calves, bad-looking hooves even in these young guys, the treponemes we found, they're known to be pathogenic. They're known to be disease causers in livestock. They're not really considered to be kind of just bystanders. We did confirm again that in these guys also, we did the same extensive testing, the histology and radiology and all that, and again, limited to the hooves. It's not affecting other parts of the body, and that does include the meat. We looked at muscle tissue. We looked at the lymph nodes that actually drain the infected feet, where bacteria would normally be trapped, you know, if it was spreading up, and the lymph nodes were all clean, the meat was clean. So we're feeling very comfortable that the meat is not affected. So, but still, we still need to get that ever elusive early lesion to try to figure out what's causing this thing in the early stages. So this is when we did the calves last August. This is Dr. Thomas Gilliam. He's with the Washington State Department of Agriculture. He came out with us for a couple days to help with these. And we did find some abnormalities in the hooves. Something's going on here. This little spot is not normal. And of the five calves we collected in Lewis County in the known affected area, three of them had these types of lesions on their just below the coronary band. The coronary band is where the hair meets the hoof. Whoa. This kind of got reformatted, but with these also, we tried the spirochete culture, and we looked for them on histology as well. Got kind of some mixed findings. When we did have those gross lesions, which was the abnormal little spot I just showed you, that's what we call a gross lesion. We did culture spirochete bacteria out of those. They were sequenced as pathogenic treponemes that cause disease in domestic animals. What wasn't quite fitting is that on histology, microscopically, we weren't seeing these spirochetes in the tissues with our special stains. So it's looking more like treponemes are involved, but still things are not adding up entirely. So our summary as of the end of August last year, severe chronic lesions in both adult animals and 9- and 10-month-old calves. In the 9- and 10-month-old calves, we're finally starting to see these pathogenic bacteria. In the 3-month-old calves, we have something that looks abnormal. It looks like a gross lesion, but we're not able to confirm that it's a lesion histologically. But we are getting treponemes out of those gross lesions. So moving on up, trying to bracket in between 3 months old and 10 months old, and the earliest we could really do our next effort was January, again, kind of working around hunting seasons, but we did collect animals last January. And we finally found lesions at the right stage that we think we feel very comfortable with our findings at this point. And what we're seeing are these little gray areas, which are swollen areas of the hoof. The hairless, that's just kind of shaved for me to get my biopsies so that the hair is not missing there normally. But it's these gray swollen areas at the coronary bands, again, where the hair meets the hoof. And if you look closer, it's this spot right here, magnified. And the tissue is kind of starting to separate here at the coronary band. So that's not normal. These are all different elk that were collected during that time, and they all have lesions at the coronary band here. And it can be in the front or the back, but still the coronary band where the hoof meets the haired area there. In this one, the next slide I'm going to show you of this one, again, here's coronary band lesions on these 8-month-old calves, is a cross-section going down here. And so that is right here. You can see this cleft here and this cleft here. And that is the hoof actually starting to separate from the underlying structures. And so this hoof is in the process of sloughing off, which is what we see in those advanced cases. When we look at them microscopically, we see abundant inflammation. All these dark purple dots are inflammatory cells. So they're cells of the immune system that are responding to something there where the hooves are separating. And if we do our special stains there, we see right there at that line where the hoof is separating and the immune response is occurring, we have these little black squiggly bacteria invading the healthy tissue, kind of drilling their way into the healthy tissue. We again did cultures from biopsies of these lesions and the DNA sequencing, and we get those treponine bacteria again, and they're kind of clustering out genetically into two of the three known phylo groups that are associated with digital dermatitis in dairy cattle. So in summary, this is what our pathologist on the case put together. This is her slide, but kind of her idea of the sequence of events is those 3-month-old calves in August, relatively good nutrition coming out of summer. They're copper and selenium deficient. It's dry, not too much happening. By the time they're 8 months old, maybe nutrition's decreasing a little bit just because of the annual cycle there. Still have low minerals. The environment's a lot wetter. Animals perhaps concentrated more. More time has occurred for disease to progress in these animals. By 9 months of age, we've really got these spiral bacteria proliferating. We're at the point of no return. The hooves that are at this stage are not treatable. They're not going to be cured. They're, again, poor nutrition, low minerals, still wet, still concentrated, more time for these changes to occur. Until the point where they're adults, the lesions are permanent. We've got secondary infections coming in, bacteria invading that damaged hooves. We have secondary laminitis, overgrowth, debilitation, and emaciation in some that are not able to ambulate very well. More time, and the disease just progresses. So as I've said, these treponemes are known to cause disease in dairy cattle. It's a disease called digital dermatitis. It's a pretty well-known disease. It emerged as a significant disease of dairy cattle in the U.S. in the mid-1990s, and it didn't take very long before it became a problem in all of the industrial, large dairy-producing countries. In a 2000 study done by the USDA National Animal Health Monitoring System survey, 70% of all the dairies in the country have this disease. Within a dairy, that lameness cases within a given dairy, this disease is responsible for 50% of the lame cattle. So I'm going to talk a little bit more about what we know about the disease based on cattle, because that's the one that's been studied the most. This is a close-up of a spirochete. They are, again, spiral-shaped. Their spiral shape allows them to literally use that movement to drill into tissue and cause their damage. They actually elicit quite an immune response. They cause the host to produce an immune response to try to fight their presence, but what happens in the process is the immune cells actually damage the elk tissue in the process of trying to attack these treponemes, and so you get like the host's immune system kind of attacking itself, and that results in all the tissue damage that we actually end up seeing. They're very, very difficult to grow in culture. That's why it's been kind of tedious to try to figure out if they're there. This here is a picture from one of our elk. This actually came from one of our January elk, and it just shows that the spirochetes are most definitely there. So the other things we know about treponeme bacteria, they're responsible for, they play a role in human periodontal disease, and so they're pretty well studied from that perspective. What we know about the studies in human periodontal disease is that by themselves, they don't usually colonize and cause damage. It seems like other bacteria, like the normal bacteria that are in your mouth, kind of have to produce particular environmental conditions for them that are favorable for the treponemes to proliferate. Either that or these other bacteria maybe cause just enough damage for the treponemes to enter, but it does appear that there's another other bacteria that are involved in this disease, the progression of the disease, which is not uncommon with many of the diseases that we know about in humans and animals. And we do know that these treponemes, though, once they do get access to the tissues and the cells, that they elaborate a lot of what are called virulence factors, like tissue enzymes that kind of break down the tissue. And so a lot of those are very well described for treponemes in general. So again, what we know about digital dermatitis in bovines, because that's where it's studied the most, it is the leading cause of lameness in dairy cattle throughout the country, possibly the world. The dairy industry suffers severe economic losses from the disease caused by these bacteria due to decreased milk production, premature culling of very severe cases that they can't treat. They'll just ship them to slaughter. Having to have them walk through foot baths as part of the treatment and prevention is an expense. And then here's just some data about how expensive it is to the dairy industry. When I spoke last June with you all, and then I think it was last March, I came over to Moses Lake and gave a little talk. At that time, I was asked, where does it persist, or, you know, does it survive in the environment? We do know in 2012, they have found it. They did find it in the oral cavity and the rectal tissue of cattle that dairy farms that have the disease. And this second article just came out in May, and they have, for the very first time, been able to detect this actually in the manure slurry on dairies. This has been studied for 20 years, and they've just now developed the techniques to be able to detect it in the slurry on dairies, and this was just last May. So this is a new finding since I spoke with you last. But it does underscore how this is still a disease that's being researched, and there's still a lot that we're trying to learn about it, even in cattle. So again, in cattle, what do you do if you have an infected herd? There's no vaccine. There have been some that have been attempted, but so far none have worked. The mainstay of treatment now is foot baths. The problem with foot baths is most of these solutions and compounds that are used are potentially very toxic to the environment. I mean, copper sulfate, you wouldn't want to get into any water bodies, for example. It's very toxic to fish and other aquatic organisms. So it's not really something we can apply to wild elk. Even if we could get them to walk through a foot bath, we'd have to deal with disposing of this toxic stuff. To be effective on the dairies, it needs to be done a minimum of 2 to 3 times a week, and most of them do it daily when the cows come and go to and from the milking parlor. The toxicity issues we talked about, for a valuable cow that you want to keep around for a while, you can treat her intensively, you can trim her feet, you can apply topical antibiotics and bandage them and change the bandage every 48 hours. But that's pretty labor intensive and obviously not an option for wild elk. So this slide is from one of our collaborators at USDA, and she studies this disease as well as leptospirosis, which is another spirochete disease. And her slide is, we've been studying this for 20 years and we do not have all the answers in cattle. And one of the reasons why we don't have as much information as we would like is that this is not a disease that you can reproduce in captivity. Attempts have been made to take to grow these treponemes in culture and then try to inject them into the cattle feet, and they have not been able to do it. The closest they've come is if they can wrap the cow's foot and keep it wet for like 2 weeks and then apply the bacteria, then you can get a lesion that kind of sort of looks like the same disease, but it's not the same disease. So again, this goes back to there's other bacteria and other factors involved, and we haven't identified all those yet. But the fact that we don't have an infection model makes researching this in captivity very difficult. And so this is all well and good. We know this causes digital dermatitis in cattle, but one thing that bothered us for the longest time during our investigations is the lesion in cattle is very classic and very characteristic. It affects the bottom, back of the foot, between the claws in almost all cases. This is not what we were seeing in the elk. What we were seeing in the elk was not beginning here between the hill bulbs in the back. And so that was another thing that was throwing us for a while. But as we continue to collaborate with our collaborators in the UK, this is where we sent a lot of our samples for culturing, was to the University of Liverpool. We learned that there is a sheep form of this disease, which we do not have in the United States. It's not been diagnosed or reported in the United States. But in the UK, in England, Ireland, and Scotland, there is a recently emerged disease of sheep called contagious ovine digital dermatitis. It emerged shortly after the cattle form did, 2 decades ago, and it looks a heck of a lot like what we are seeing in our elk. And these are some of the papers just describing, you know, this finding in sheep. Again, in the UK, not in the U.S. We don't see this in sheep in the U.S. But the sheep form, it's the same bacterial community profile as the bovine form. Treponemes are the ones that cause the damage, but there's other bacteria too, and we're still trying to figure out which of these is significant in start of beginning the progression of that disease, but it's the treponemes that cause the disease. And these are all pictures from sheep. This is just, it was pretty remarkable when we finally kind of made that connection that the sheep disease, it starts at the coronary band, just like we're seeing in the elk. It doesn't start at the bottom and the back of the heels like it does in dairy cattle. It looks remarkably like the disease in sheep, and it's caused by the same bacteria as digital dermatitis in dairy cattle. And so here's just a sheep foot showing the coronary band starting the lesion there, and then here's one of our elk. And untreated in sheep, the same thing happens as we see in some of our elk. Eventually that whole hoof's capsule just sloughs off and you're just left with that underlying tissue. And as in the sheep, this isn't a great slide, but there's a lot of squiggly little treponemes, little black lines in there, and from a biopsy from a sheep, and then here's an actual biopsy from our elk, and again with the squiggly black treponeme bacteria. And these are just a variety of pictures of the disease in sheep, and we've seen lesions, feet like this on our elk. We've seen every one of these lesions represented in elk. So given our findings from our January collections, where things finally started to make sense, sharing the information with our technical advisory group, which I don't know if you guys received a handout of a technical advisory group that we formed to kind of help guide our diagnostic process and help us assess the findings. But it's a 16-member group consisting of veterinarians and researchers from a whole lot of institutions. I can talk more about it if you like later. But anyway, we had a meeting on June 3rd. We looked over all the data, and we came to 3 consensus statements based on that. The first is that available evidence that we have is most consistent with an infectious bacterial hoof disease. Infectious because of the pattern of spread that we saw early on. It spreads like something infectious. It's not a point source thing where the disease is just in one spot. It is transmissible. And bacterial, we can tell histologically by the kind of immune system cells that come into the damaged feet. That kind of response is elicited by bacteria. So this is what we're seeing. It's bacterial. The particular disease shares many features and resembles treponema-associated contagious ovine digital dermatitis, as we just went over. And with all infectious hoof diseases of livestock, and probably with elk as well, environmental factors, and especially wet conditions, are likely important in causing this disease to become initiated and to propagate. And that's for 2 reasons. If the animal's feet are constantly wet, the skin is damaged, the tissue is damaged, and bacteria can more easily penetrate. And then the other thing that likely occurs is that the moist environment allows bacteria to survive long enough for it to be transmitted to the next animal that steps in that same spot. We did a brainstorm during our technical advisory group meeting of information needs, and it was just a brainstorm because everybody had to leave to go catch their flight. We're going to have more meetings and kind of refine our kind of information needs more later. Is it being maintained in the elk population? It looks like it is. It looks like it's being maintained and spreading in the elk population, even where we don't have them sharing areas with livestock. Is there any effect on movements? I mean, do their movements and habitat use affect their likelihood of getting disease, or does their disease, having the disease, affect their movements and habitat use? So there's that question. Is this something they develop immunity to? Does not seem to be the case in domestic animals. What are the effects on survival and reproduction? And we are going to initiate a study this winter looking at that. How does the disease progress over time? I mean, we've kind of seen it spread, but we haven't really quantified it, like how quickly or how many are affected, et cetera. And how does the disease progress within the individual animal? That would be helpful to know. How is it transmitted? Is it present in the environment? Is there soil and fecal sampling that we can do that might tell us if it's in an area or not? This is just, like I said, a brainstorm of things we came up with. I was asked to just mention a few, address a few questions and concerns that we very frequently hear, and I'll try to do my best at that. We've been asked why we don't just do live animal testing. We have not ruled out any kind of live animal testing. This winter we will be radio collaring animals, live animals, and we'll be collecting samples from them, and we will be seeing how affected animals use the landscape and whether what their survival is, whether the hoof disease seems to affect survival, whether it seems to affect reproduction. So that kind of live animal testing is going on. Those are the questions we need to know right away for management. You know, how is this disease affecting population dynamics? We have interest on the part of our collaborators, particularly at USDA, where they have captive elk herds already. And then also our pathologist from Colorado State University is interested in some live animal testing. So there are discussions ongoing. The trick is going to be figuring out the questions to ask and then asking ourselves, can we answer those questions? I mean, for example, if we can't produce the disease artificially, that's really a limitation to hands-on live animal testing. So anyway, nothing's been ruled out, but we just need to be thoughtful about how we proceed on doing live animal testing. Herbicides, there's a large belief that herbicides used by in industrial forest practices might be having an effect. All I can say is that there is nothing in the veterinary literature to say that herbicides would cause this kind of hoof disease in any animal that's ever been looked at. Herbicides are used throughout the West Coast in forestry management. The herbicides, specific ones that have been brought up, atrazine and Roundup, are very commonly used throughout the country. They're used to grow corn, which is fed to livestock. You know, I'm not a proponent of herbicides necessarily. In fact, I buy organic whenever I can, but we just don't have any scientific literature information telling us herbicides would have a role. And then more importantly, when we look at the animals, we don't see any evidence of toxicity that would be herbicide-related. We don't see any immune suppression in the animals we've looked at. So some have suggested that herbicides might be causing immune suppression, thus making the animals more susceptible. But we've looked at that, and there is no evidence that they are immunosuppressed. So that's all I can say about herbicides at the moment. And then, I mean, we've got a diagnosis. It's this disease. It's a digital dermatitis-like disease that is very common in livestock in this area. Another theory out there is leptospirosis, which is another disease that's caused by spirochetes, but a different genus, a different family of spirochete bacteria. Leptospirosis causes liver and kidney damage. It's actually quite common in wildlife in Washington and a whole lot of species. In most species, it doesn't cause a problem, but in some it does. And when it does cause a problem, it's a kidney and liver problem. And we looked at the kidney and liver of animals, these elk, and it's not there. We did do some testing, blood testing, as a result of concerns and questions about leptospirosis, and we found, not surprisingly, that we have evidence that animals in western Washington are exposed to leptospirosis. We have evidence that animals in eastern Washington are exposed to leptospirosis. There is no correlation between disease status and exposure to leptospirosis. So, you know, and plus in this group is vets, it's 16 vets, and we know how to diagnose diseases, and we would recognize leptospirosis, and this is not it. So that's what I have to say about that. Safety of the meat I covered. I hope we did look at all these tissues microscopically, including the meat, and we are confident that the disease is limited to the affected hooves. It does not affect the meat. And that's it. So do we take questions now, or?
What's the second part?
About the management approach.
Oh, no. Let's talk about the science first. Again, really packed full of information. You clearly have been looking at this very, very hard. Your background and credentials, you're a veterinarian, you are an expert. So I just appreciate getting this rich base of information, because the public alarm, the public concern about this problem is obvious. So, questions? Commissioner Caney?
Chair. Yes, excellent presentation. It's very, whether it's wolves or ungulates or anything, you know, getting back to the science and having this type of information is the key, I think, to calming the fears. And, you know, we got to get this information out as best we can. But I do have a question on the I know it's hard to speculate, but you said the sheep in the U.S. do not have the disease, the bacteria. So, but it's a likely transmission mode then. Could they have gotten the elk or possibly picking up from dairy cows? And that transmission mode, though, could be sharing pastures, wet pastures or whatever. I mean, that's a possibility. And then once elk have it, they can take it to further locations and actually transmit it, not from the, you know, in a pasture location. But does that all make sense to you, or is that plausible as how this is kind of slowly spread into an elk population?
Yeah, that's a good question, and I do think that's very plausible. Yeah.
One of the things that came to my mind was I know to deal with manure waste, they often put it in ponds, and then sometimes they're applied to fields. And I'm not sure, but I think I've heard that it can be applied to forest lands too. Do you know anything about the manure management practices that, you know, we'd want to definitely look at if there's a...
Yeah, I don't know about forestry. I do know that nutrient management is a really big issue that dairies need to deal with, and it's a huge issue. And I think, you know, that is a practice in some areas where they apply it to their fields where they grow their crops.
Commissioner Holtzmiller?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I can sympathize with you. We used to run sheep, and foot rot, not this type, but foot rot in general was an issue. What percent are you seeing in the elk? And I mean not down to the exact percent, but I mean what percent of the herd are you guessing is affected by this in this region?
Yeah, that's difficult. That's another study that we're going to start this month, I think, looking at prevalence and distribution, trying to get some good numbers. We just have anecdotes, but, you know, it's not difficult to find an affected herd down in Southwest Washington that has animals limping. And when you find an affected herd, a large proportion of them are lame, and just anecdotally 30 to 80% within a group. It's pretty bad.
Well, and there again, dealing with another type of hoof rot, but I know we found it was very congenital, that if we had problems with you and kept a lamb out of her, it was an issue. So that's, in our setting, we cull it and take care of the deal. So
yeah.
Thank you.
I had another question. I heard that they're starting to see it in Oregon. Is that true? Where and where?
Yeah, one of I had a list of all the personnel that helped us in the field, and one of those was my counterpart from ODFNW, because mm-hmm. you know, they're just across the river and they want to know what's going on here, and so she was out in the field with us during those collections, and so they've had two suspicious-looking cases. They've sent them into their lab at Oregon State University. They found a lot of – they look really similar to what we saw. They have not done, like the next testing, like the specialized bacteriology, because it's pretty hard to do. And then the specialized stains, they've not done that, and they don't have the hooves anymore. But as a result of this, they are upping their surveillance and trying to get the word out to the hunters that they want feet that look abnormal.
I can imagine they're looking at us, thinking we don't want to be there. Commissioner Kenny?
I keep thinking of more questions. Is the bacterium long-lived? I'm thinking like the picture up there where the elk are moving through. Let's say they had some bacterium, ended up in that soil a month later if elk move through. Are they long-lived, or does it have to be concentrated and immediate, or you don't know? Don't know.
We don't know.
Okay, and finally another question. About the live animal testing, I've talked with a representative from the most affected area, and he just encouraged us to seriously consider live testing, and I inquired with the department about what had been done. So can you explain what we have done to offer the opportunity for researchers, independent researchers, to conduct the kinds of studies they'd like to pursue? Is that a Sandra question?
We haven't had any formal proposals. We frequently hear we think the department should do live animal testing, and we've asked people to submit a scientific collector's permit, which would be the initial step, and we haven't really received anything to evaluate. So,
okay. I heard.
I think should, yeah. So, I mean, we do have live animal testing being discussed with bona fide research institutions. So, those discussions are ongoing.
What I wanted to get out on the table is that we're being very cooperative and trying to be helpful with those who have their own theories that they'd like to pursue. We're not obstructing anything.
Yeah. We invited one gentleman to attend our technical advisory group meeting in June, and the opportunity to present a proposal with the idea that, if he felt he wanted to do it, here's a scientific collecting permit, but we just, like I said, we haven't received any applications.
Okay. Any other questions? Really, I think the next subject is also going to be very, very interesting. What you do about it.
Thank you.
I think you really have located a lot of information. You've generated a good basis of information, scientific information, about what is causing this problem. Now, what do we do about it? This is the next subject. Item number 8, Southwest Washington elk recreational hunting. Oh, is this Sandra?
This is part 2.
Oh, no, this is part 2 of number 7. Sorry.
No,
Jerry is the next one.
Yes.
Good afternoon. Thank you for letting us continue the discussion. My name is Sandra Yonker. I'm the Wildlife Program Manager for Southwest Washington with the department. And the continuation today is, as Dr. Mansfield identified, the what's been done to date and what do we know to date. And like you just mentioned, what can we do or what are the next steps? So just to go a little bit of background on what we have completed to date. Back in 2012, we set up the Elk Hoof Disease webpage, provided an online hoof disease reporting form, which many folks have provided input of when they're out and about, if they've seen elk with hoof disease or not, just letting us know where they're seeing it. We've developed a frequently asked questions page as well as a webpage for the Hoof Disease Public Working Group with information that we've been covering there. Also, in last year's as well as this year's hunting pamphlet, we provided information on hoof disease, and then we also developed a hoof disease brochure, which I have some examples here if you'd like, just with some informational Q&A, basically, with regard to hoof disease, to what we knew. And this came out in January, so it already needs to be updated, but just trying to disseminate the information as best as we can. As Dr. Mansell mentioned, we have the Hoof Disease Technical Advisory Group composed of veterinarians and researchers, obviously to guide our diagnostic effort as well as discuss the different research and management questions. We also developed this Hoof Disease Public Working Group, believing it would be very important to work with members in the community to have that opportunity to discuss research as well as management questions and options, share any information that we had to date, and just have that opportunity to communicate with folks. We've had 4 meetings to date since we developed the group last October, and this is made up of folks with a variety of interests, from county commissioners to both public and private landowners, sportsmen's groups, local business owners, so really a good representation and a good healthy dialogue. We've also developed the proposed WAC as well as the emergency WAC to leave hooves on site from elk that are harvested in Southwest Washington, which will be presented to you for your consideration after this presentation. We participated in 2 citizen-hosted as well as 3 WDFW public meetings as an opportunity for information exchange, asking, providing information, listening, Q&A as well. We reviewed and approved a joint Department of Health and WDFW game meat safety flyer, which is now online, so hopefully that will be helpful for folks as the hunting season approaches. And then with multiple input from both the technical advisory group, the Hoof Disease Public Working Group, staff, and experts in the field developed a management approach. We've also, as of 2 days ago, hired a hoof disease coordinator, which will be very helpful given the magnitude of this issue and the lots of work that we need to get done. Will help coordinate the department response, conduct citizen science efforts, and as well as implement some of the management options. As Dr. Mansell mentioned as well, as this research has been ongoing, wanting to disseminate to as many folks as we can, but also have the dialogue in the scientific community. It's been presented at Wildlife Disease Association conferences. As she mentioned, just this last April, one of the papers was published. In July, there was an article in the Washington State Veterinary Medical Association newsletter with regard to the issue. Just last July, Dr. Mansell presented at the Wildlife Disease Association, and then just 2 days ago, just submitted another paper. So really important with regard to having that dialogue in the scientific community as well as the peer review of the work that we're doing. And the list is pretty long. I didn't include it on the slide of what's upcoming with regard to articles that are in preparation, conferences, presentations, and just working with our co-managers like NODFMW and to talk about how we can move forward. So with regard to identifying how do we implement all of this, we have identified new funding for state fiscal year 2015. And we're using supplemental budget request from 2014 to bring the coordinator on board. $180,000 has been prioritized from Pittman-Robertson funds to go towards a survival study, and I'll go into a little bit more detail on that in a little bit. We also applied for a grant with the Rocky Mountain Elk Foundation, and were awarded a grant for $8,000 to help us with the analyses of the samples that we submit. And then we are submitting a budget request for the 2015-17 biennium of $250,000 to help with continue to understand the cause, the prevalence and distribution question that you had mentioned, the survival study, developing the protocols, and implementing the management approaches, as well as many other things, I'm sure. So I think one of the, as we've gone through this this effort, I think one of the most sobering outcomes of this is that once hoof disease is in a herd and once it's on a landscape, it's extremely difficult to eliminate. And I think that really causes pause. I think we all would want to find a cure and have it go away, but I think that's a sobering point, and that's what we are faced with. So really the challenge is not can we eliminate it, the challenge is how do we manage this and how can we hopefully minimize or reduce it. So with the technical advisor group as well as with the public working group, we work through several different management options and research questions through several meetings. We discussed with folks different management options, such as would it be beneficial to reduce the density of elk in response to the disease? Would it be beneficial to contain the herd in some form or manner? Would it be feasible to treat the herd? Is it an option to just let the disease run its course? And as we went through those, through several meetings, brainstorming on the pros and cons of each of these, trying to think of what's the cost of doing something like that? Is it feasible? Is it sustainable? Is it a long-term measure that'll have meaningful impact? So lots of layers of difficult questions to answer to management options that are not easy to implement either. Also, a lot of input with regard to what are the questions that we need to answer. And as Dr. Mansell showed, there's a long list, and we try to prioritize our first step in terms of biting off some of the questions that we need answers to. So the top three are to look at what is the prevalence of the disease in the herd, what is the distribution across the landscape, does the disease have an impact on the survival of the herd and their reproductive capability, and then, of course, to continue to identify or understand the causative agents. So what we did is we compiled all the information from all these different discussions and deliberations that we had with the public working group, that we had with the technical advisor group, as well as with our own staff, and developed the following management approach. So what are our current needs? To continue to identify and understand what is causing the disease, to determine the prevalence and the distribution of the disease in the population, document the effects on the elk population with regard to survival and reproduction, and then where feasible, where can we manage the disease? I just put the slide in because I know you don't need me to talk about this, as Dr. Mansell just went through it and she described all those informational needs, but just that is ongoing as well. With regard to determining the prevalence and distribution of the disease, we're going to be working closely with a group of citizen science volunteers to collect prevalence and distribution information. So how we are going to do that is we're literally in the final stages of trying to develop and finalize the protocol to implement that. And what we would like to do is, before we go out on a full-blown effort, is to do like a pretest to make sure that the protocol that's developed, we can collect the data that we want, that the data that is collected is meaningful, and that it'll be able to inform us with regard to what we want to do management-wise. And then we'll try to do that here in August, prior to the hunting season, and just try to get that information, understanding that the animals on the landscape, their behavior and their movements will definitely change with the hunting season. So try to get a pretest out before that happens so we can bring those data back. However, while folks are out and about, during whether it's hunting or just out and about, we will do a broader call for assistance to help us, and I'll go into detail how we'll do that, to collect distribution data in the fall so that we can have as a continual and ongoing effort. So here, the colors are sort of coming out. Okay, so it is an extremely large landscape that we are talking about. This is the Columbia River right here. So we obviously manage on game management units. Those are pretty large sometimes. So what we have done is to look at watersheds to try to make it a little bit of a smaller unit of sampling. They're called HUCs for short. And looked at the density of elk along these different watersheds. And then a big thank you to all the people who went online to our online reporting forum and provided their input, because based on the input that they've been providing for the last year and a half, we have developed this reporting density. And so if you look at this map, the dark sort of turquoise color and the lighter shade of blue, I guess, lighter shade of turquoise, whatever that is where we have reports of two or more animals that are limping within a group. Then if you look at that sort of yellowish shade, that is where sort of an average number of animals are reported that are limping. And then you have this sort of dark tan color where we have a low level of a number of animals that are reported with limping with hose. And then this sort of light non-color is where we don't have any reports yet of animals that have been reported as limping. And so based on this, what we're going to test here in August is we're going to select an area where we have a high level of number of limping animals, a medium, and a low. And then we're going to zoom in and ask a small group of volunteers to help us test this. And, for example, this would be a watershed here, and do two different methods to see what will work best. Do a predetermined route, as you're seeing here in the red. So we'll tell volunteers just to drive these roads, you know, for example, start at 6, end at 11, and document as many herds as possible, and then within those herds, document whether or not you have limping elk. We're also going to try a different approach to see which one works the best, is not have predetermined routes and just have the folks drive around in a certain area, look and find as many elk as you can, and then report that back. So we're going to do that this August. And then the larger effort this fall, these turquoise outlined areas are basically, if you look back at the previous map, are those that shaded area where we have not had any reports of limping elk. Basically, what we're going to ask this fall is, while you're out and about, please provide us with any information that you have. However, we would like to focus you or target these areas in turquoise, because this is where we do not have any reports yet. So if you could help us basically determine, do we not have reports there because people just haven't been there, or are there really no elk with limping hooves there? So we'd like to focus volunteers to help us in those areas, but of course, wherever you are, we welcome that input. But we would, so that call for volunteer help will happen in the fall during the hunting season. And what we'll do is, everybody is comfortable with different ways of collecting information. We'll have a paper form that you can fill out. We'll have the online version like we have right now. And we're in the process of developing a phone application so that folks can download that too, if you happen to have a phone that has that capacity, that you can input that information while you're out in the field. As Dr. Mansfield mentioned, we also want to start something this January, February, and looking into the effects of hoof disease on elk population dynamics. The way that we'll be doing that is with an extensive new effort by, with our staff, radio collaring afflicted animals and looking at their survival and their reproduction, excuse me, as well as their movements relative to non-afflicted animals. So we'll be doing that, developing that design this fall in conjunction with our elk specialist, with the regions that are involved in this, regions mainly regions 5 and 6, although as you saw on that map, we do have some incidents in region 4, as well as with the hoof disease coordinator. With regard to how can we manage, and one of the items on that list was manage the disease where it's feasible. As Dr. Mansfield went over, there's different things that can be done in domestic livestock with animals that have hoof disease. So I just wanted to go over what are the steps for hoof disease management and understand that these steps are basically have been developed and implemented when we're dealing with domestic livestock. So there's a long list of things that can be done, some that Dr. Mansfield has gone over. And as we look at this long list, and as she indicated, some of these are probably not going to be feasible for a wild herd, free-ranging herd. But going through the list, if you want to see maybe what we can and cannot do, if we're looking at biosecurity, would it be feasible for us to quarantine new animals? Probably not very likely that we would be able to do that. Could we isolate newly infected animals from the rest of the herd? I would probably put a question mark there. We may indirectly be able to do that, but not directly. In terms of all these treatments, whether it's cleaning and paring out the hooves, bandages, foot baths, keeping the animals on clean ground, rotating pastures, excuse me, vaccinating animals, even if there was a vaccine, and as you mentioned, there isn't one, I think we can start putting the red lines through these, as these are probably not feasible for free-ranging elk herd. For the last two, in terms of selecting for genetically resistant animals, there might be an indirect way of doing that, as well as being able to remove animals that are severely affected or that fail to respond to treatment. We will put a question mark there, too, that we might be able to approximate those. So looking at that long list, recognizing that there might be maybe three, one or two that we could implement, understanding the challenge ahead of us. In addition, in terms of trying to eradicate a disease, it requires several things to be in place. It requires the ability to identify all the infected animals, even those that are not showing signs yet. And we know that animals with hoof disease can be clinical, but to have no signs, so it would be very hard to identify whether or not they already have the disease. It requires the ability to locate and remove all the infected animals. Excuse me. The ability to prevent movement of infected animals, and as well as to access the property to where they are. I think we can recognize here as well that of these things that we need in order to do this, these are also going to be very difficult and likely not feasible. However, I think the best that we can do is try to approximate it, do what we can to try to get to some of these goals. I'd like to provide a concept that is used to implement these management goals. So the concept basically is that you have this core area and that in theory you would remove and disinfect the disease from that core area. So you would have to remove all the animals from that core area. And around that you would have a buffer or a control zone surrounding that core area where you would only remove the affected animals and then quarantine the rest. And then you would have this sort of perimeter area where you would have that enhanced surveillance of making sure that not newly infected animals sort of cross the line, so to speak. Understanding that the concept here, again, would be very hard to implement, but there are some things on this that maybe we can use and, again, try to approximate what we can from what is needed to actually do disease eradication. And that's why we're at disease management and not disease eradication. And I think it's really important to pause and acknowledge up front that any of these approaches that we've discussed and that have successfully been used to manage disease in domestic animals will be entirely experimental when applied to free-ranging elk. We really have to learn as we go along and adapt and be flexible with what we and be open to what we're learning. So given that of that long list of things that could be done and likely the shorter list of what we can actually do, which is, I know, pretty sobering. What we will do is work with landowners on possible fencing options so that we could proactively reduce the possible risk of transmission. Again, as Dr. Mansfield said, we're not quite sure how it is transmitted, but really it would be a precautionary measure while addressing, for example, where we can respond with regard to crop damage. We would look to coordinate with staff and others to respond to sightings of elk that are severely affected, so that have severe clinical symptoms, and remove them from the population. And here what we would do is, using that concept that we just went over, look in those core areas of the disease to reduce the prevalence and in that perimeter to try to reduce the spread of the disease. So what are we going to do? This August, like I mentioned, we're going to do this sort of pretest to a larger scale effort, and then the distribution effort in the fall as well. Get that test data to inform a more comprehensive effort, and then implement additional, volunteer-based efforts in the spring of 2015 for both prevalence and distribution as we get the data and see how we can use it and hopefully tweak it or make it better and go back out after the hunting season. We will implement the removal of severely affected animals, and we would do that working with staff and possibly working with master hunters to help us. We are in the process of developing the criteria for that, how we would implement that, for example, just to identify what is a severely affected animal so that people know what they're looking for, and then what are the criteria for euthanasia. And we are working on developing and implementing the survival study. And as I mentioned, we're looking to do that in February, to start that in February and March. And that would be a long-term study. We're also developing a policy to no longer translocate elk outside of Southwest Washington. That has been done in the past. And I want to make sure that we do not do that. Definitely continue working with both the public working group and the technical advisory group as we move forward. As we, Dr. Mansfield talked about, there were some questions with regard to assessing the feasibility of monitoring of live animals with hoof disease. Oops, something happened to the. We've also reached out to the National Academy of Science to see if they are willing to guide and assist us on the hoof disease work that we've done to date, any recommendations for future research, or questions such as herbicide. And then as we adapt and learn and have more information, reach out to not only the landowners but also hunters with regard to the next steps and where we are and understanding what the department is doing. And with that, I'd be happy to take any questions.
Terrific. You anticipated all my questions. Any questions? Anyone? Let's see. I'm going to ask Michaela here to ask her question. But there was one that I thought she was going to ask about. So are you going to ask about volunteer science?
No.
Okay. I thought I could predict. Go ahead, Michaela.
All right. I actually had a question about the last section. You said that the sheep and the cow hoofs were different, like in different spots, and the sheep were more like the elk. Have you compared the differences between the sheep and the cow, like microbiology-wise?
That's a good question. I have not personally, because we don't have cases in the U.S. of the sheep disease, at least none that have been reported, but it is becoming a very significant disease in the United Kingdom in their sheep. And I should just maybe, just for those of you who don't know, but there's a reason probably that it's more a problem in sheep in the U.K. is they do share pastures routinely, and here in the U.S., usually they don't. Usually there's range sheep, they don't, But anyway, the studies that have been done in the U.K., they do have the same bacterial profile the sheep and the cattle diseases do. They just affect different parts of the hoof.
Mm-hmm. Any other questions? The question that I was going to ask was, do you want information on non-occurrence? Because I live in one of these zones that in which there's no reported sightings as yet, but in Southwest Washington. And so you answered that question. Yes, you will be collecting information on the non-occurrence too. So, and by the way, the website I thought was terrific. I thought it was very easy to understand and use, clicking on the location that you thought you saw things in. It's a good job. Commissioner Keeney?
Thank you. That is a question for you, Dr. Mansfield, again, was I think I heard the presentation say that the bacteria is anaerobic, so it does not need oxygen. Does it only exist where there is no oxygen? And you know enough to say that in its entire life cycle? So this, when I think of lagoons, that's definitely a possibility. When I think of very, very wet soils, well, they usually dry out at some point. You know, unless they're very wet. I'm just trying to understand it more. Can you tell me a little bit about what you know about the bacteria?
I don't know if I can. I'm not a microbiologist. I do know that when they culture these things, that they have to be cultured in anaerobic conditions for them to grow. Some of the bacteria are partially anaerobic or facultatively anaerobic is what they say, but that's about the extent of my knowledge.
Okay. Excellent job.